This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There's no sense of balance between the different branches of government in this constitution, meaning parliament, the judiciary are totally subservient to the one individual who's the presidency.
That was Zaid Al Ali, a senior advisor on constitution building for the Arab region on Tunisia's new constitution. Details coming up. Also, African energy giants Algeria, Nigeria, and Niger have signed a memorandum of understanding on a vast gas pipeline offering Europe potential alternatives to Russian supplies. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A senior Ethiopian official says the government is ready for talks with rival forces from the northern Tigray region anytime, anywhere, and without preconditions, in a notable break from the past. William Davison is an Ethiopian senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. His latest article is titled, At Long Last, Ethiopia Prepares for Peace Talks. I started out by asking him why the two sides are now ready to move towards negotiations.
Well, it seems that part of the reasoning is that the two parties were engaged with other allied forces, were engaged in such a brutal conflict over the last 18 months or so, with no clear resolution to it. So, a certain amount of exhaustion from the conflict and the consequences of that, obviously devastating. A failure to achieve their political objectives by military means, that seems to have contributed to the decision to try, at least make some sort of effort to pursue a negotiated outcome. And we could also, very much part of that is the economic conditions, the terrible conditions in Tigray, which remains almost totally isolated.
So what obstacles would negotiations face should they get going?
We do have a fairly major disagreement over who should lead the mediation. The federal government wants the African Union and the envoy, Olusegun Obasanjo, to lead the mediation. Tigray seems to favor Kenya and the current president, outgoing president Kenyatta, and say that Obasanjo is too close to Addis. So that's actually a fairly major obstacle. We also have very recently Tigray's president, Debretsion Gebremichael, saying that services need to be restored to Tigray before talks can commence, and also suggesting that the issue of Western Tigray needs to be resolved and returned to Tigray from Amhara control before talks can begin. That's another major potential obstacle here. There's also the significant issue of the size of the forces that Tigray has built up during this war. They will be looking to maintain that force for Tigray's security, but that force is seen as a threat by the federal government, also by Amhara and Afar regional government, and also by Eritrea's government as well. So the issue of Tigray's forces is there. We also have the continuing federal designation of the TPLF, Tigray's ruling party, as a terrorist organization. So at some point, presumably, there would have to be some movement on that if this peace process is going to be successful. So there are obstacles getting the talks underway, but even when the talks get underway, there are incredibly tricky, thorny political challenges that will need to be overcome.
You mentioned the large force, the Tigray force. Could armed confrontations flare back up again?
Yes, it's still in a very volatile situation, obviously. At the moment, further confrontation between the Ethiopian National Defense Forces and Tigray's forces doesn't look so likely. That's been one of the improvements over the past 7-8 months now. But of course, there is still the potential for a confrontation. They're also very much between Tigray's forces and the Eritrean military. They're facing off across the border in the north. We've seen skirmishes.
And Mr. Davison, let's conclude by the role of foreign partners in the negotiations. What is the role?
The important role is this potential mediator role for any talks to get underway. Is that going to be the African Union? Is that going to be Kenya's government or some sort of partnership between them? So that will be an absolutely critical role. We then also have other partners supporting the process. So the US and its envoy, now Ambassador Mike Hammer, We have the European Union and its regional envoy, also the UN Secretary General's envoy. They're all playing sort of supporting roles here, engaging in shuttle diplomacy, facilitating whatever, you know, helping to support whatever mediation process gets underway. To some extent, the United Arab Emirates have been involved. So all of these partners are either involved in facilitating, potentially hosting, mediating the talk, or sort of encouraging the parties.
That was William Davison, Ethiopian analyst from the International Crisis Group. He talked to me from Nairobi, Kenya. A Kenyan court yesterday ordered a politician running for deputy president to forfeit almost $1.7 million that was frozen in a corruption probe. Justice Esther Mayana ruled that Rigathi Gachagua, who is presidential candidate William Ruto's running mate, has failed to explain the source of the money that was found in his bank account and should therefore surrender it to the state. The case, according to the Associated Press, highlights the endemic corruption in Kenya, where the anti-graft body last month raised integrity concerns to more than 200 candidates running for various offices in the August 9th polls. Gachagua, who in court papers said the money came from his company's business dealings, blasted the ruling and vowed to appeal. Both outgoing Deputy President Ruto and his main presidential rival, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, have pledged to tackle graft, but voters remain skeptical as the corruption infects almost every level of society. Kenyans will next month elect not only a new president, but also several hundred members of parliament and about 1,500 county officials. Global health agencies say a voluntary licensing agreement has been reached to allow for the generic production of the first and only long-acting injectable HIV prevention drug. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Until recently, cabotegravir, the HIV prevention medication, was available only in pill form and had to be taken daily or in some cases before and after sex. The injectable form can provide 2 months of continuous protection against HIV infection through a single intramuscular injection. Hervé Verhoosel is spokesman for UNITAID, the global health initiative that spearheaded the agreement. He says the price of the injectable drug is prohibitive, noting a year's supply in the United States costs $20,000.
That's a lot of money. That's why that product cannot be used today in low and middle income countries. This license will in fact give the option to three different generic manufacturers to develop the product on a generic base. Of course, that will help to bring the price of the generic version down.
Data from UNAIDS, the United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, finds 1.5 million people were newly infected with HIV last year, including some 650,000 deaths. Ferhusel says cabotegravir will be available to people at high risk in the least developed, low-income, lower-middle-income, and sub-Saharan African countries. He says people with high rates of infection will benefit most from this medication. They include men who have sex with men, sex workers, transgender women, adolescent girls, and young women.
And I would like to insist on the importance of protecting adolescent girls and young women. In sub-Saharan Africa, the epicenter of the epidemic, the HIV infection rate of adolescent girls aged 15 to 19 is six times that of the male peer, and six times greater.
Verhoosel says the agreement will give selected manufacturers the opportunity to develop and supply generic versions of cabotegravir in 90 countries, where more than 70% of all new HIV infections have occurred. He notes it might take 2 or more years to develop the generic product. He says the price, which is not yet known, will likely be determined then. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, the Global Conference on AIDS opened today with the goal of achieving a world in which HIV no longer presents a threat to public health and individual well-being, bringing together experts from around the world, including South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Egypt. It runs through Tuesday in Montreal. Convened by the International AIDS Society, IAS, the group says its participatory approach involves community representatives, researchers, and policymakers. The annual IAS conference has been spotlighted by a number of celebrities, including music performer Elton John, and luminaries, including British Royal Prince Harry. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our program from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Congolese officials say the death toll from this week's protests against UN peacekeepers in eastern North Kivu province has risen to 22, including 16 civilians, a Congolese army officer, one peacekeeper from Morocco, and two UN police officers from India. Rights groups and analysts say the animosity and a plan to deploy an East African force into Congo puts the future of the UN peacekeeping mission into question. Victoria Monga reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
In a three-day protest, demonstrators accused the UN peacekeeping mission MONUSCO of failing to achieve peace while leaving citizens vulnerable to ongoing attacks by M23 rebels. Rights groups say the UN operations in DRC is having a limited impact because of the region's many armed groups and complex political dynamics. Thomas Fisi is the senior DRC researcher for Human Rights Watch.
After so many years on the ground and the situation being at its worst, one can question the UN strategy and its failures. But blaming MONUSCO only isn't going to solve the situation. In many parts of eastern Congo, the Congolese state is nowhere to be seen, and the Congolese armed forces have a poor human rights record, with units often involved in violence against civilians.
Although militia attacks have raged in DRC for decades, massacres, abductions and burning of homes has surged since March, when M23 rebels re-emerged after nearly a decade of ceasefire. According to the UN, 97 civilians were killed in June alone, and over 700,000 have been displaced since January. In June, the East African community agreed to send a regional force to DRC in hopes of quelling the violence. A security analyst in Kenya, George Musamali, believes the force can make a difference.
We are not sending a force, a peacekeeping force. We are sending a fighting force. So definitely the role is going there, fighting the rebels and making sure that they are removed completely from the equation in DRC.
But Amnesty International researcher on Congo, Jean Mobert, has little hope the proposed force can do a better job than MONUSCO.
The military approach by the East African community is business as usual. It's just the same approach that has been used over and over and over, and instead of resolving the conflict, it has worsened it.
The United Nations has made plans to wind down in its peacekeeping force and gradually withdraw from Congo. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the United States strongly supports Tunisia's democracy and the aspirations of its people for a secure and prosperous future. But he expressed concern for the country that set off the Arab Spring, saying its new constitution passed Monday with low turnout could weaken its transition to democracy and erode respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. Experts on Tunisia's democratic transition warn of a return to a one-man rule. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi has the details.
Blinken said in a statement issued yesterday, "We share the concerns expressed by many Tunisians that the process of drafting the new constitution limited the scope for genuine debate. Zaid Al Ali, a senior advisor on constitution building for the Arab region at the International IDEA and an independent scholar, agreed with Blinken's concern, saying the new constitution looks very much like the 1959 constitution, which laid the framework for Tunisia to be governed as an autocracy for half a century until the breakdown that led to the 2011 uprisings.
There's no sense of balance between the different branches of government in this constitution, meaning parliament, the judiciary, was referred to sometimes as the fourth branch, meaning independent institutions, are totally subservient to the one individual who is the presidency.
Al-Ali added that the new constitution firmly places policy formation and implementation in the hands of President Kais Saied. It also established the power of the president to dissolve parliament under certain circumstances and limit the power of the judiciary. All branches of the government would be subservient to the president in this structure. Eli Abu Aoun, North Africa Program Director at the U.S. Institute of Peace, said the process by which the new constitution was drafted indicates a sharp departure from the ideals set in the 2014 constitution. He cited two major concerns which could return Tunisia to a strongman rule.
One of them is the absence of checks and balances on the presidency. So irrespective of the personality of the name of the president, this will increase the risk of going back to an authoritarian regime. The other area of concern has to do with the judiciary, the safeguards to make sure that the judiciary is an independent institution are very weak, if at all existing.
Experts say Tunisia has experienced an alarming erosion of democratic norms over the past year and reversed many of its people's hard-won gains since 2011. They say Saied contributed to democracy backsliding 1 year ago by suspending parliament and subsequently dissolving the legislature and suspending the constitution, which he has now redrawn to reflect a hyper-presidential system with no checks and balances. That's why Blinken demanded in his statement that an inclusive and transparent reform process is crucial to begin to restore the confidence of millions of Tunisians who either did not participate in the referendum or opposed the new constitution. Blinken urged the swift adoption of an inclusive electoral law that facilitates the broadest possible participation in legislative elections planned for December, including those who opposed or boycotted the constitutional referendum. Blinken said, "We also commend the dynamic role played by Tunisia's vibrant civil society in building an inclusive political future." Hamad Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Uganda is appealing for refugee support as numbers continue to rise, especially from Congo, where hundreds are fleeing across the border to escape insecurity and violence. Officials say Uganda has hit its annual refugee admission target in just the first half of the year. Only 20% of what is required to host the refugees is available. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Since January, Uganda has seen an influx of Congolese refugees fleeing fighting in Democratic Republic of Congo. These are joining the estimated 1.5 million refugees already living in Africa's largest refugee host country, Uganda. But officials say the numbers are overwhelming. Hilary Onek is Uganda's Minister for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees. He says the country is currently constrained to provide the basic needs for the refugees.
The requirement for settling them, that is giving them accommodation, plus feeding them continually, looking after their health, giving them education, requires about $804 million. And currently, during this emergency appeal, we got a pledge of about $47 million so far. But we do expect maybe more responses, otherwise we may not be able to manage this situation.
Douglas Asimwe is the acting commissioner for refugees. He says the new arrivals have already surpassed the numbers that Uganda and the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, budgeted for this year.
This year alone, our joint contingency plans with UNHCR estimated to have 60,000 from January to December. Within half year, we've already made 63,000 refugees. So the projection now is that we may hit 100,000 refugees, new arrivals, by December. And that calls for enormous resources.
According to Asimwe, money is needed to get more land to settle the refugees. He says most of the settlements are full and that insufficient space jeopardizes the refugee settlement model of giving them enough space so they can build their own resilience, especially through agriculture.
We are running short of spaces in terms of settlement areas. We need to open up new settlement sites, and all this calls for heavy investments if we are to maintain the progressive refugee settlement police approach.
Minister Onik has also hinted at talking to refugee home countries to agree on shared responsibility or an option of setting up internally displaced people, IDP camps, on their own land.
In Congo, I don't know whether they have such a force which can look after IDPs. Maybe the UN could probably look after the Congolese potential refugees into IDP camps. They can create big IDP camps there, and the donors can assist them within their country. But similarly, South Sudan also, the same. So those are the options we shall have to discuss with our neighbors and see whether that is workable. That would be a more practical solution to this running away in large numbers and overloading Uganda.
The biggest percentage of refugees in Uganda come from South Sudan and the DRC. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 25 years since the United Kingdom transferred control of Hong Kong to the People's Republic of China. That transfer was made with the promise by Beijing that for 50 years Hong Kong would be allowed a high degree of autonomy and that the people of Hong Kong would be guaranteed their fundamental freedoms. The PRC has broken its promises, however, and made a sham of the one-country, two-systems framework established under the Sino-British Joint Declaration and the Basic Law. As National Security Council spokesperson Adrian Watson said, in a statement on the 25th anniversary of the transfer, "We have witnessed the dismantling of Hong Kong's democratic institutions and the unprecedented pressures on the judiciary, the stifling of academic, cultural, and press freedoms, and the coerced disbandment of dozens of civil society groups and news outlets." In 2019, millions of Hong Kongers took to the streets in protests that started with controversial extradition legislation. In response, Beijing passed the so-called National Security Law, which has served as a pretext for Hong Kong and PRC officials to stifle dissent. Authorities have jailed the opposition, with many imprisoned for over a year, noted Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a separate statement. Hong Kong leaders have raided independent media organizations, shuttered museums and removed public works of art, weakened democratic institutions, delayed elections, prevented vigils, disqualified sitting lawmakers, and instituted loyalty oaths. They have done all of this in an effort to deprive Hong Kongers of what they have been promised. In a recent policy address to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, then U.S. Consul General to Hong Kong and Macau, Michael Hanscom-Smith, noted that Beijing's actions have shaken the institutions and practices that have been the basis of the international confidence that Hong Kong has long enjoyed. The people of Hong Kong are suffering, and many businesses and young professionals are fleeing a city where stability and adherence to the rule of law are rapidly eroding. Consul General Smith said U.S. officials have a simple message for their Hong Kong and PRC counterparts. Let Hong Kong be Hong Kong. NSC spokesperson Watson said, "We call on the PRC to act in accordance with the international obligations it willingly undertook, and the United States continues to urge the release of those unjustly detained."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Justin Twait, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.